Nebraska tribe. Deborah Van Fleet has more.
Corn from a Winnebago family's heirloom seeds is grown organically, hand-picked, harvested, and processed as closely as possible to the way it was done by the tribe's ancestors. Ho-Chunk Farms agriculture business manager Corey Cleveland says the Indian corn harvest involves several steps and several generations. He explains that after the corn is picked and husked, it's boiled and blanched for 10 to 15 minutes, followed by the wash goo.
A lot of our elders like to come and do the wash goo, and that's taking off kernel by kernel with hand and spoon. This is a time a lot of our elders will share stories.
Following the wash goo, the corn is dried on screens for 2 or 3 days and then put in quart-sized bags. Cleveland says the corn is then frozen and typically used in a traditional corn soup. He says approximately a third of this year's 350 quarts will be distributed to folks who helped with the process. Students in Winnebago Public Schools also participate in the Indian Corn Project. Cleveland says even students as young as first through third grade get involved by helping husk.
So it's good to have their help. If we can have them say, hey, mom and dad, I went to help with the Indian corn today. That is what we're trying to do with the Indian Corn Project.
The Indian Corn Project also contributes to the Winnebago tribe's goal of food sovereignty for its community. I'm Deborah Van Fleet.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 10th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is myself, Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. Our director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. So if you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth, up next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. First, China threatens to retaliate against clothing manufacturers over forced labor. Are you wearing a Calvin Klein jacket or a Tommy Hilfiger outfit? That could be a political statement. It indicates that you oppose China's repression of the Uyghurs, since the parent company of those clothing brands, PVH, has refused to buy the cotton for its garments from Xinjiang province as a protest against forced labor there. Xinjiang accounts for about 90% of all the cotton grown in China. China has threatened retaliation, arguing, seriously, that it's discrimination. Its commerce ministry has given the company 30 days to respond to that charge. Beijing could sanction PVH's suppliers and factories in China. This case has broader implications. It's part of a consistent pattern in which the Chinese authorities try to leverage the dependence of international businesses on China to force their adherence to Chinese human rights practices. The European Union is caught up in just such a situation over tariffs on Chinese electric vehicle imports, my next subject. Volkswagen in China is a specific case in point. As the New York Times reports, quote, the Interparliamentary Alliance on China, a group with lawmakers from at least 22 countries and the European Union, issued a statement calling for Volkswagen to withdraw from Xinjiang. Volkswagen is Germany's largest automaker and has a 190-employee joint venture in Xinjiang with a car maker owned by the Shanghai Municipal Government. Chinese state-owned enterprises, like Volkswagen's partner, follow Beijing's lead in opposing any withdrawal from Xinjiang. The Alliance issued its statement after Dr. Adrian Zenz, the director in China Studies at the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, issued a report that cited a leaked audit that Volkswagen had commissioned. His report said the automaker had failed to properly investigate accusations of complicity in Xinjiang's coercive policies toward Uyghurs. Volkswagen has said that the audit shows it behaved appropriately and was not building cars in Xinjiang, where workers prepare cars for delivery to dealerships. A footnote here. Under U.S. law, the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act of 2021, a variety of goods that originate in Xinjiang are banned from being imported. Most recently, the ban was extended to a Chinese artificial sweetener company and a steel manufacturer. Robert Silvers, Undersecretary of Homeland Security for Policy, said, quote, "No sector is off limits. We will continue to identify entities across industries in China and hold accountable those who seek to profit from exploitation and abuse." The European Union votes to raise tariffs on China's electric vehicles. After months of debate within the EU, the vote to raise tariffs passed, reflecting disagreement about how to confront China's competition, but also a consensus that China unfairly subsidizes its auto exports. 10 countries voted for the higher tariffs, 5 voted against, and 12 abstained. The tariffs on Chinese EVs, which take effect on October 31st and will last for 5 years, go as high as 45%. That's considerably lower than the US and Canadian 100% tariffs on Chinese EVs. Both Beijing and the EU agreed to continue negotiations, reflecting their huge commercial relationship. China is the EU's second most important trade partner after the US, with the total trade in 2023 valued at $815 billion. One observer commented that the vote sends, quote, "a signal that there's an emerging consensus in Europe that stronger pushback against China on the economic front is needed," unquote. As an example of the pushback, consider what Denmark's Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen said, quote, "I don't think it would be possible for Russia to have a full-scale war for more than 2.5 years now without help from China. We cannot continue a situation where China helps Russia in a war in Europe without consequences. They have to be held responsible for their activities. You cannot, on the one hand, let Russia attack another European countries and continue like nothing has happened," she said. "We have tried with all actors on the global scene to have good cooperation. We tried it with Russia, buying their gas and their oil," Frederiksen said. "I think we have to try doing the same with China, have normal cooperation between partners on different aspects and topics. We cannot allow ourselves to be naive. You cannot go back to the situation before the war in Ukraine, and the same goes for China now," unquote. It remains to be seen whether or not China will retaliate with tariffs on EU imports. One Chinese official vowed that China would, quote, "take all measures to firmly safeguard the interests of Chinese companies." Humanitarian aid workers are military targets. One of the world's most dangerous professions these days is humanitarian assistance, especially in the Middle East. According to the Aid Worker Security Database, quote, "despite a meticulous process in place to ensure aid worker safety in Gaza, the leading cause of death in the humanitarian sector over the last 11 months has been Israeli airstrikes. Of the 378 aid workers killed worldwide since October 7, more than 75% have been killed in Gaza or the West Bank," unquote. Sadly, these deaths have occurred despite proper notification being given to Israeli soldiers about aid missions. A senior official with Doctors Without Borders told the UN Security Council in February, quote, "A disturbing pattern has emerged. Aid groups share their coordinates with Israeli authorities and then are attacked by the Israeli Defense Forces at those same coordinates." The Doctors Without Borders officials said that this pattern of attacks is either intentional or indicative of reckless incompetence. In other news, the tipping point for Earth's natural systems is near. Global warming is bringing nearer the day when the crucial natural systems that regulate the environment are damaged beyond repair. A New York Times report, based on the latest scientific findings, says that these natural systems are so vast that they can stay somewhat in balance even as temperatures rise, but only to a point. Once we warm the planet beyond certain levels, this balance might be lost. The effect would be sweeping and hard to reverse, not like the turning of a dial, but the flipping of a switch, one that couldn't easily be flipped back. The systems they address are familiar to most of us. They include permafrost thawing, collapse of Greenland ice, breakup of Antarctic ice, a sudden shift in the West African monsoon, loss of the Amazon rainforest, and the erosion of coral reefs. For example, with regard to the latter, even if humanity moves swiftly to rein in global warming, 70 to 90% of today's reef-building corals could die in the coming decades. Next, a senior U.S. official questions policy in Israel. Samantha Power is head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, AID. Before taking the job, she was a crusading journalist who gained attention for her book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, which argued that preventing genocide after atrocities in Rwanda and the Balkans in the 1990s should be a central concern of U.S. policy. Now, as head of AID, Power has had to deal with many employees of the agency who have been distressed and have protested over U.S. aid to what they believe is a genocidal regime in Tel Aviv. They challenged Power to put her values to work by joining their protest or even resigning. Jonathan Geyer writes in New York Magazine about Power's situation, the all-too-common problem of power versus principle. Being head of a large government bureaucracy imposes restraints, she has found. Geyer recounts this story, quote, "One staffer described members of Power's team as frustrated and angry at the circumstances, sometimes coming into the office crying. The exasperation is very, very clear and evident, the staffer told me. At a town hall meeting, Power assured upset staffers that the administration was doing everything it could to cajole Israel into letting more aid into Gaza. President Biden believes that maintaining the relationship is the best way that we can leverage more humanitarian access, she said, adding that Israel must do much more to facilitate this work. Now that's the official line. Don't change policy in order to ensure access to Netanyahu, which has not turned out very well. Power supports a ceasefire, but is not about to criticize official policy publicly. Recently, Geyer reports, quote, "The White House dispatched Power to Dearborn, Michigan, to defend Biden against a protest vote organized by Arab and Muslim voters incensed over his support for Israel. In a closed-door meeting with community leaders, one attendee described to me Power's moral pain about the situation in Gaza, but said that in their view, she just is powerless. And we have to keep in mind, as the author relates, that Power would be in line for Secretary of State if Kamala Harris wins election." Backlash over Europe's anti-deforestation law. A European Union regulation intended to protect the world's tropical forests has come under assault from developing countries, corporations, and major countries such as the US and China. The regulation, adopted in 2023, bans all products derived from seven key commodities: cattle, cocoa, coffee, palm oil, rubber, soybeans, and wood, cultivated on newly cleared forest land. Such a rule clearly would affect numerous household products and would require careful tracking along the global supply chain. The common request now is that the EU delay implementation of the regulation. Yet, as the New York Times reports, a few countries have taken steps along the lines of the EU rule. Quote, "Some countries already have monitoring systems in place. Argentina and Uruguay have been tracing cattle for more than 15 years. Ghana, one of the world's largest exporters of cocoa, has mapped 1.2 million farms so far and has said it can start tracking cocoa beans from farms to ships next month." Biden's rules on methane and mercury upheld by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court on October 4th refused to block new Biden administration rules requiring fossil fuel-fired power plants to slash emissions of mercury and other toxic substances, and requiring oil and gas firms to curb methane, a potent greenhouse gas, from their drilling operations. One other case before the court's emergency docket is a plan to curb greenhouse gas emissions from coal and gas-fired power plants. All three cases were brought by Republican-controlled states and some power generator companies. The Environmental Protection Agency says the new methane regulations announced in December will reduce emissions of the gas by 80% between 2024 and 2038. Methane, which the EPA calls a superpollutant, has 80 times the warming power of carbon dioxide during the first two decades it is in the atmosphere. It accounts for about 30% of the current rise in global temperature. Georgia's application to join the European Union is in peril. Georgia is the next European state that might vote for a far-right leadership. If it does so in elections October 26th, it will not be allowed to join the EU. That is the concerted view of EU's ambassador to Georgia, who said, quote, "If Georgia becomes a one-party state, a country where political opposition is banned, where civil society must go abroad to work, and where fundamental human rights, not to mention minority rights, are not protected, Georgia will not be able to become a member of the European Union. Not today, not tomorrow, not the day after tomorrow." He appealed to Georgia's voters to vote for European values. What has gotten the EU members particularly upset is a law, similar to one in Russia, that requires Georgian organizations that receive foreign funding to register as foreign agents. That law clearly targets organizations that work with Western non-governmental groups concerned about human rights, the environment, and labor rights. Finally, the U.S. and South Korea are close to agreement on cost-sharing for U.S. forces there. When Donald Trump was president, one of his cost-saving targets was U.S. forces stationed abroad. He demanded that the host country pay more, a lot more, something like rent, for being defended by those soldiers. The fact that security alliances also serve U.S. interests was irrelevant to him. South Korea, with about 28,500 U.S. troops deployed in several bases, was one of his targets, and the matter became a serious source of controversy. Now, the Biden administration has headed off the issue by proposing that the Republic of Korea, South Korea, pay 8.3% during the first year of the five-year deal, amounting to $1.1 billion. Additional increases, capped at 5% per year, would then be applied. The South Korean parliament and leadership must approve the deal, which is highly likely since it locks in the payment issue through the next presidential cycle, avoiding the possibility that another Trump term would again raise Korea's share of the costs. And that's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening and take good care.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. As Portland rushes toward Election Day, at least one controversial policy is falling through the cracks: public input on a temporary mass shelter for more than 150 people. The site is slated for construction in St. John's on an isolated brownfield situated on a trucking route with no sidewalks, no bus, and no services. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with community organizer Charlotte McDonald about two public meetings being held by the city tonight and next Thursday to gather public input on the sites.
Charlotte, thanks for being with us. This issue has a lot of details, and as a neighborhood activist, I know you've worked to help develop other shelters and poverty services in Portland. What's different about this one?
What's really different about it is the size. It's going to be massive. In addition to the size, it's the location. And the location is farthest outside of any service networks that any other shelter has been conceived of and developed. And so this one's going to be a complete experiment. It is important to frame what's going on. We do have a houseless emergency in our state. We do care about people, and we can't let 10,000 or more unhoused folks living around the Multnomah County area. The point is, we can't let this happen. So it's been going a long time. And one pivotal moment was in February of 2022, when Sam Adams, who was then working in the mayor's office, though he was not an elected official, and in February 22, he proposed a plan to create large mass homeless camps. And you can only use the word mass homeless camp when you're talking about a 1,500 person camp. And that's what he proposed back in February 22. And at that time, his idea and the mayor's team was to create five of those camps. So that would serve up to 7,000 people or more. That was back in February 22. So here we are 2.5 years later. And I would still use the term mass camp to describe some of the larger camps that have been developed, because I still think that 200 people is a mass camp in the whole menu of how people can be housed. A lot of folks have been developing micro villages, for instance, that would be limited to 21 people. So 200 people is still a pretty big size. And this one we're talking about today, TAS 2, Temporary Alternative Shelter Site number 2, is number 2 because number 1 opened in July 2023. And that one's called the Clinton Triangle. So Clinton Triangle opened in July 2023. So that was about a year and a half. That was 18 months after Sam Adams first announced that.
So I wanted to go through a list of what's wrong with the St. John's site, because the list is really significant. There's probably people out there thinking, you know, any place is good enough because we need some place to house our family, our friends, our colleagues that don't have a place to live. But this is different. So let me just start. It's far from services, right? It's on basically like a truck road that has no sidewalk, and it's on a polluted site, which is, talk about that.
Yeah.
Can we just talk about what the shortcomings are? Because there's a lot more of them than we usually see, I think.
There's so many more. And I did want to make sure that we know that this is task number 2. It's proposed to be the second temporary alternative shelter site. And what makes it, what is on the list that makes it inappropriate? I always want to keep pointing back to there's a different TAS 1 that's in operation. It does not have these factors. So TAS 2, it is on a 45 mile per hour truck route that is in the Rivergate area. The Rivergate, you know, we're here in Portland. We have an active port, and Portland has ships. Portland has deliveries of all kinds of truck cargo. And so coming up and down this road, it connects Marine Drive to Columbia Boulevard. The road is called North Portland Road. And it is a very important truck route with a pretty high speed limit because it has constant truck traffic. And it does not have safe passage for individuals, housed or unhoused, to go up and along that route. In fact, tragically, there have been a history of bicyclist deaths on this road. So we already know that folks who are pretty aware of traffic, because you're a bicyclist, you're pretty aware of traffic, they've been killed on the road by trucks passing by. And so that's number one. It is just not a safe road. And then number 2, this location is so North Portland Road, you can kind of situate it if people want to think about Portland, think at the Portland ends of the Columbia River. The Columbia River is our northern boundary. This is within about a half a mile from the Columbia River. So we're right up to the edge of the city. It's in the industrial area, and it is not close to services. It's not close to a bus stop. It's not close to a store. It's certainly not close to housing services. They're a couple miles away, walking without a bus. That really differentiates this site from TAS 1, which is nestled right in the core of inner southeast, which is just close to all kinds of public services to connect people with housing, food, rehabilitation, especially drug treatment and rehabilitation. That's all available over there. But over here, you know, you have to walk almost 1 mile to the closest bus stop, and you have to get more than a mile to the closest Freddy's. There is a 7-Eleven about half a mile away.
Hmm. You know, my concern is that, again, I hear people talk about unhoused people as if it's they, but I always think of it as us, right? This can happen to any of us. And so when we think about where the people we care about are already living in an unsafe situation, but that doesn't mean that we should accept every single solitary unsafe aspect of these camps. So talk about it a little more. Like, what about the pollution and the brownfield stuff?
Yeah, the pollution. And I'd also like to talk about what other unhoused folks are already experiencing right in this same area. And that does involve pollution. But this site in particular was the redeveloped brownfield. And sometimes dollars speak really well. We can understand what a dollar means. the Department of Environmental Quality, the city, which includes the Bureau of Environmental Services, have been involved and planned and now carried out a $9 million redevelopment of this site. So $9 million redevelopment of the site because it needed it. The site was completely polluted and there was a public meeting. There were actually a bunch of environmental groups that came out in December 2023, six different groups, including Audubon, Tualatin Riverkeepers, Willamette Riverkeeper, Portland Harbor Community Coalition, Friends of Smith and Bybee Lakes, Columbia Slough Watershed Council. Those, I'm dropping those names because we know that those are the kind of folks that track pollution. They're looking at these wetlands and wild areas, and they all came out to say, hey, this is not an appropriate place to house folks because it is a brownfield. And they brought up, even if the place could be made safe, they brought up the fact that it's not zoned for residential, which again calls out the fact that it's not zoned for people to be close to services. But it also means that there's no place for their waste to go. You know, there's no infrastructure for water. It's not really within the boundaries of even like a fire or police coming out for an emergency. It's not close in to anything. But they also brought up this pollution issue. I got the word out back December 2023, and we all fought to not let this even happen because it was a dirty place. This site had been a truck wash, and prior to that, shingle manufacturer. I mean, this site has been used for almost 100 years for industrial use. The soil was just packed with EE and other toxins that, you know, none of us, these toxins are not the kind that roll off the tongue. It's complex, absolutely inappropriate for human contact kind of toxins. That's why they had to spend $9 million and put a 1 foot thick asphalt cap on the site before they could even have unhoused people there.
So we've got far from services. We have just a straight up unsafe stretch of road where people have already been killed by trucks and traffic. It's a polluted site. Talk about how has this site rolled out and have people had an adequate opportunity to give public comment about it?
Absolutely not. I know because I've been one of the few voices trying to create space to have public comment. And so the process that these have been following on other places is that the shelter services, which is the little bit of this tiny little department of the city that's running these new sites, they have in the past engaged with a set of different groups to get to create good neighbor agreements. And so they have tried this in other places. They had created a good neighbor agreement for task one of the Clinton Triangle at Southeast Gideon and about 14th. It's kind of like 14th and Clinton area. They did a good neighbor agreement over there back in the early summer of 2023. They spent 3 months and they engaged with business groups and community groups. And I think it was a lot easier over there because there are more business groups and community groups in a non-industrial site, like in the middle of the city. So they got the Inner Southeast Business Coalition, which is part of Venture Portland. They had some neighborhood associations. They had six groups over here in St. John's. St. John's is a very interesting territory of our city. It's huge. It contains the terminals. It contains Terminal 5, Terminal 4, which are active port terminals. It contains Kelly Point Park. It contains the Rivergate District. These are not very highly populated areas with people. They're places where lots of workers come and work on a daily basis. So the regular way that the city would get input is to send out an announcement on the internet to a neighborhood association. So the people that are involved in the closest neighborhood association, which is St. John's Neighborhood Association, they live over by Cathedral Park, and it's huge. I think it has 10,000 people living in St. John's area. So That's unfortunately what happened. They did send out some postcards in around May or so. And I know people over at Pier Park that didn't even get the postcards. There was one meeting, one community meeting, and the city did bring a mediator. And believe me, they needed that mediator. People were yelling, saying, the general consensus, what I remember people saying was, you do this to this North Portland community over and over again. You come, you don't ask us, and then you just dump a big additional problem on us without having addressed the previous problem. So there hasn't been an opportunity to engage. But there is a twist to the story. When the government, when the shelter services did make that gesture, the St. John's Neighborhood Association did something kind of historically fascinating. The St. John's Neighborhood Association volunteers said, no, we don't want to enter into a good neighbor agreement because we don't honestly think we represent this entire huge area. They were very honest. You know, these guys said, no, don't let us be the ones making a decision that affects an enormous number of people that aren't engaged. Don't use us as kind of a pawn. So I actually kind of respect what they did. But unfortunately, when they did that, they left nobody engaged. There is finally something about to happen, though. There are two meetings. So finally, because the city, the shelter services does know that they must have a good neighbor agreement on the books, who had been engaged with the guy whose name is Hank Smith. And I like to email him frequently. So he announced about a week and a half ago, there will finally be two public meetings. And everybody is invited. So I'm going to share that information right now. Both of these meetings will be in St. John's.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience. KBOO, Portland.
KBOO's listeners value community, authenticity, and inclusion. If your business aligns with these values, underwriting on